The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live Exchange. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished investor and stock trader Michael Taylor of Shifting Shares. So welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak in person.
Yeah, well, we've had lots of big macro data news this week. We've had Bank of England decision, the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan, alongside sort of like softer than expected CPI data in the UK. But before we sort of dig into the details, I don't suppose you could quickly take us through what type of stocks you like, what kind of investor and trader you are.
So I'm more of a trader than an investor, so I would, but I do use fundamentals. So it depends. If I'm doing a technical trade, it's purely chart based, and I don't really care what the business does. You know, if anything, the business is a life support machine for the stock. But if it's going to be a swing trade or a bigger size trade, you know, I will look at the fundamentals. So first I'll check the chart. Generally, if it's like a stage four downtrend, I'll just avoid it because, yeah, I prefer my stocks to go up. And then I will look at the fundamentals to see if there's a catalyst or is there, you know, earnings upgrades or is there something fundamentally changed about the business that is going to propel the shares higher. So yeah, more technicals, but I do look at fundamentals as well.
And what sort of time scales do you look at? As in sort of like, you know, for your trade, is it sort of like a weekly, fortnightly, monthly, 6 monthly?
Really depends. So intraday trades can be a couple of minutes, even a couple of seconds. My best trades in terms of quantum and percentage have typically been from 6 to 9 months. And I think even future, I held over 2 years. That's
long-term trader then.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's quite rare for me to hold something for over a year. But it can and does happen. You know, if the trend is going up and the business is priced fairly, and you know, sometimes if there's no reason to sell, I don't. But as I say, that's quite rare. Probably 6 to 9 months is probably my sweet spot.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if anybody wants to ask myself or Michael any questions, please just put them into the chat box. We do have one coming in. It's gone straight into the juggler here. So apologies for this, Michael. But do you make any money from trading? And also, the other one was about follow up was sort of like, do you need any training for trading on the markets?
Well, I've had so the first question was, do I make any money trading? Yes, I do. It's never enough, but you know, in terms of paying my bills and everything, you know, it's doing okay. 2020, 2021, obviously fantastic years. 2022, 2023, harder. It's very famine or feast trading. You can't expect to just turn up and do, you know, your sort of 40 hours work and get paid a regular income. Sometimes you're going to have outside profits. Some months you can work 60 hours a week and lose money, and someone in McDonald's has earned more than you. But if you enjoy what you're doing, it's good fun. But certainly for anyone who's averse to hard work or averse to risk, probably not the best profession. In terms of training, I'm not a suit. I've never worked in the city. I've never had any formal trading education. Trial by fire, I guess, and I also got a bit lucky because I started in 2016 and 2017 was like a crazy year for small caps. So I was able to grow capital and I also borrowed quite a lot from Deutsche Bank as well. So I turned that into, you know, a reasonable size sum quite quickly just by taking on a lot of risk. If I hadn't have done that, I probably wouldn't have been able to go full time when I did.
Did you borrow money from Deutsche Bank? Was that they're your prime broker, are they, or something?
No, so I had a job. I was a telephone terrorist. I was a recruiter for 6 months in Frankfurt, and I was making way more money in the stock market than I was in my job, but I was putting, you know, barely any time into it because, you know, I'd go to the gym, I'd get the office for 8, sort of leave 6, 6:30, catch up on everything, read, learn about the stocks, until I'd go to bed, and then it would start again. So in the end, I just thought, you know, I can take a risk. I can try and do this full time. If it doesn't work out, I just get another job because, you know, that's it. Like for someone who's got a really big career, you know, they've got a mortgage and kids in private schools, it's very different to go in full time on the market than it was for me, you know, at the time. Wasn't married, had no kids, had no mortgage. It was at the very start of my career. So I could just walk into any job like that, you know, the next day.
And
So in
how did
terms
they?
of risk to reward, it was quite different.
Yeah, and how did they, Deutsche Bank, did they secure the debt against anything? Or was it against your positions? It was basically leverage on your
No,
stock.
it was just a personal loan. So I walked into Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt, asked to borrow money so I could invest it in stocks, and they said that they don't do that here. And it was quite funny because the guy ripped up the application and he said, "What? Well, we'll start again, but you know, maybe you want to go on holiday or maybe you want to buy a new car." And I was in my head, I was thinking, you know, these are the reasons that you shouldn't borrow money. Like you should borrow money for assets. So I'd said, "Well, funny you should mention that. I want to go on holiday." Got the money approved to go on a holiday. Then we didn't go on holiday, and it went into my trading account. So
He's brilliant.
quite a weird set of circumstances. And you know, I would just like to say I would never ever recommend anyone to do what I did. You know, maybe that's a bit hypocritical, but I understood the risks and I was comfortable with that. But generally borrowing money to, you know, trade in risk quite risky AIM stocks or even invest it is now nah, I just wouldn't recommend that. Because obviously it carries a lot of risk. That's not to say you shouldn't do it, but you should be aware of the risks.
Yeah, and do you still use leverage, or have you actually paid your loan back?
So the loan was actually paid back in January this year, funnily
Oh, okay,
enough.
well done.
Yeah, so I never paid it back because it was quite low rate of interest. So I just didn't really see the point. You know, if my returns are higher than the interest on the money, it doesn't really make sense to pay it back. But yeah, that loan's fully paid off now after 7 years or so.
Well done. And then there's another question just coming in terms of the companies with the short interest stocks. Do you take what can investors sort of like interpret from those? Because it's published every single day from the FCA and then gets sort of redistributed to various websites, so people can always obviously see it. But it shows you the which companies are most shorted, and that's they're always quite edgy companies.
To be honest, I don't look at it. That's not to say that you can't make money looking at it. It's just that I don't. And there's going to be lots of things in the market that I don't know. You know, every day is a learning day. But I've got no strategy to, you know, capitalize on that. But yeah, generally, if a company is heavily shorted, and you're looking at the stock, you shouldn't ignore that because what a lot of people don't get is that shorters have to be, you know, because the risk, if you're a professional shorter, you know, your risk is actually unlimited. You wear a lot of risk. If you're a retail trader, it's capped at the with the negative equity from ESMA. But if someone is going to go short on a stock, they have to have done the research because potentially they can lose everything. And it's not, you know, if a stock has got a lot of short interest, there's probably a reason. You should at least be aware of what that reason is so you can assess whether that risk to reward is right for you.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at the short interest, I mean, if you do get a sort of like some positive news flow, then you can get a bit of a squeeze going off. Or alternatively, you just put something on Reddit or Wall Street Bet or Wall Street Bets about how positive the company is, and everybody gets on board, which is what we saw with a lot of very clever hedge funds who went short on those meme stocks in 2021 got taken out to the woodshed, didn't they?
I mean, there was one in Ocado in 2018 when they announced a Kroger RNS. I can't even remember if there was any numbers in it, but you know, I think the stock more than doubled on the day, just because there was a lot of people short. So then not only have you got shorts covering, but you've got people buying, and even people buying to squeeze the shorts.
Yeah.
So if there is a stock with large interest, that puts out very good news. You know, sometimes you can get a move off a short squeeze. It's not something I do often, but something to be aware of.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, let's move to one of the stocks I know you're interested in now. Let's go to Gulf Keystone Petroleum, which is an oil and gas business out in the Kurdistan part of Iraq. So it's right out there into the frontier market, so to speak. Let me put
you
the
wouldn't
chart
go on holiday there, that's for certain. Yeah.
Let me put the chart up. Can you see that, Michael? Yeah,
I can. Yeah, I can see that. Thanks.
And just to give people a bit of a sort of background to the actual company, it operates a huge, I think it's the Shaikan field out in Kurdistan. It's got a massive deposit of oil to draw out. I think it's got a useful life of well over 35 years. So huge amount. License goes to well into the 2040s. But currently this year, it's had a bit of a problem on the fundamentals basis, because I think there's a dispute between the Iraqis and the Kurdistans about the flow of oil through a pipeline, which has meant that they haven't been able to export. Can you take us through how you're viewing this? Because at the moment, I think it can only sell oil locally in Kurdistan at a much lower rate rather than exporting it.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. So I don't hold this stock. And if you zoom out, you know, that is what I would call a stage four downtrend, you know, where the trend literally just goes down.
Yeah.
So personally, it's not one. I mean, people
have been saying it's cheap. Yeah, okay. It's come down from well over £10, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, if you look in 2023 in March, I think it's 3 days to the year that the Iraqi-Turkey pipeline has been closed. You know, until that is resolved, personally, I think you can't really buy the stock without, you know, expecting more downfall. I mean, people keep saying the pipeline is going to open, and then we get a little spike, and then it doesn't. But personally, I think if that issue is resolved with the cash generation of this business, then I think there could be a big price appreciation. Obviously, could be wrong, but that's a trade that I'm looking at, and that's on my watch list for that news to be, you know, where the Iraqi-Turkey pipeline is fixed, everyone's happy, the oil's flowing, because this is a big cash generator. It does have some problems collecting payments from the KRG.
Getting any payments out.
Yeah, which is not ideal. So it's not without risk. But I think in the last cycle, this company paid its price in dividends alone. It does pay quite a lot of dividends. Mm. But I'm looking at it in terms of capital gain from that pipeline to be resolved.
And what would be the trigger for you sort of like buying before they announce the actual?
I wouldn't.
Oh, you'd wait until the actual announcement, because wouldn't the shares move quite rapidly then, just to reprice?
Probably, and that's the trade.
Yeah. Okay.
And then you might get people who are late to the party looking at the dividends and assessing the risk. So I don't think that it will be, you know, I don't think it'll resolve in a day. The price will be priced at where it should be. Generally, when a stock puts out good news, you've got something called post-earnings announcement drift, where the stock typically trends higher over weeks and months. So that would be, you know, a scalp trade for me, but potentially also a swing trade.
Yeah, okay. All right, okay, good. Well, I mean, I think just to give a bit of sort of like detail on that one with the export, I mean, I think in 2022, before the pipeline ban, then I think the realizable value per barrel for Gulf Keystone was roughly in the 70s, about mid $70 per barrel. Whereas now domestically, it's only been able to charge 27, and I think it's break even on 27, which means that you're right. If suddenly they get that release, then they can get almost $50 extra per barrel on the on the crude price, which should largely fall down to the bottom line. So a big uptick, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I must admit, one I prefer in the area, just as a bit of a lower risk, is Sereka Energy. And
definitely low risk, that's for sure.
Let me just share the screen. if you want to get into oil and gas, and I don't own this, just to let people know, but this is a UK, or should we say North Sea oil and gas producer. It does it split roughly 50-50. And what I particularly like about it is that the actual cost of production, the unit cost, is only about $20 per barrel, because it sort of like is getting extending the life of current reserves in the North Sea and getting more from the reserve, getting from more from the deposits than the sort of majors, and has got a really low cost model. About 90% of its reserves out there in the North Sea are already producing assets, and it's got a lifespan of about 10 years as well. So this is really a bit of a cash machine. And the reason why the oil, you know, the shares have performed badly of late is simply two reasons. One, because people are a bit worried about the global economics and the downturn in the oil price. But actually, the oil price has firmed just recently. And then the other side is the UK government in the budget has extended the emergency pandemic tax on the oil and gas industry out in the North Sea, which has hit off sentiment. They've only extended it by, you know, another year, I think, to the end of the next parliament, sort of like 2029. But even on that dynamic, it still trades at very reasonable valuation. I think it's on a PE of, well, I mean, if you believe the numbers, at less than four. It's got cash on the balance sheet. It hasn't actually got to do a shed load of investment either. So it looks extremely cheap for people who, you know, want to take a more of a long-term view. And it pays, I mean, if you believe it, it pays over a 10% dividend yield. So the market is definitely pricing in the dividends and sustainable. But given the balance sheet, it's got cash and it's generating a lot of cash. I think that's fine myself. So I would highlight that one as a lesser geopolitical risk. And that's how I would play oil and gas, is not going to the really frontier markets.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. If you've got patience, you know, I can't really see this company having the same payment issues. So, you know, it for me, trading is all about balancing risk to reward. If you're going to take on a lot of risk, you need to be compensated for that through higher reward. And sometimes the best trades are from really good companies where the risk is actually a lot lower than what people think. So you can get a nice trade off that. You certainly don't need to trade risky companies to make money in stocks. No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move to another one you're interested in, which is Reynolds, which is the sort of mechanical engineering chain manufacturing business in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I think it's got a, sort of like a quite a large pension deficit, but the technology is great in terms of, you know, its customers. And it provides these sort of like conveyor belts, I think, into the mining sector, but also a lot of industrial applications. And also, I think they go into sort of like airports as well for sort of baggage handling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take us through what sort of piqued your interest here?
Yeah, so it's been in an earnings upgrade cycle since 2022, but the shares haven't really done much until recently. It's on a single digit PE. There's been no shares issued. You know, so the company has been through this downtrend in 2022, 2023.
It's done pretty well recently.
It's done pretty well recently. Yeah, I guess if you look at the last sort of 6 months or so.
Yeah.
But yeah, personally, I think this company can keep growing its profits. And because of the low PE, you know, if the market decides to, let's say, rate that from 7 times earnings to 10 times earnings, you're getting a 50% uplift on the price.
Yeah.
And you were getting the higher earnings. So to me, that's the trade. You know, it's in an uptrend. It's broken out. No new shares issued, which is a positive. Pretty resilient business. And as I say, you've got the low PE with the earnings growth. That is like a bit of a juicer in the price.
Yeah. How do you interpret the sort of like the 50-day and the 200-day? Because there's sort of like, if you look at here on the chart, back in October 2022, the 50-day went above the 200-day.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really look at moving averages that much, as in I look at them, but I don't take note of like golden crosses or
hanging
man or whatever these patterns are called. I'm looking at the candlesticks and the volume to tell me what the price is actually doing.
Yeah.
Recently it broke out of that 34p level that it tried hard to break out of for quite some time. Another thing, there's been a seller holding this back. So for the last 2 years, every time it's put out good results, someone's dumped right into it.
Right.
So the fact that this is now breaking out is a sign that the seller or sellers have potentially eased, at least for now.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know who that seller is at all? No? Or
I've got no idea.
No idea. Okay, good. All right. Another one in that sort of industrial sector that I'd highlight to investors. I don't own it, but has had some really good results this week is Mpact. I don't know if you've ever looked at this one, Michael, but it basically does high-speed packaging and automation machines to largely the food and beverage, the healthcare sector, and also increasingly the energy sector. Let me just put the chart up. You'll see what I mean, where the terms of the shares have done pretty
well.
It's
quite a nice chart.
So yeah, no, it jumped up another 10-15% on the news this week, and came out with sort of prelims. And what it basically said was that sales were up 17% organically to about 114 million, improving margins. In fact, if you re-engineer the numbers, the second half margins were about 9% EBIT compared to sort of like 4% first half. And that was just a normal sort of normalization, actually, of the profitability of the business. And the management, the board are guiding towards doing organic growth long term. They're aiming for 10% like for like and 10% EBIT margins, and they're not actually that far away from it. Admittedly, you know, it has got some cyclicality because it is GDP dependent, but it's building up a big services business, which is supplying sort of like spares, repairs, and maintenance services, but also at trying to add on sort of remote diagnostics into the business to help customers do preventative maintenance. And it's got, you know, obviously it's got a pretty good story in that respect. It's got a bit of cash on the balance sheet, and the pension deficit is just about sort of all paid off. So it's not surprising the shares have done well, because they're playing into a lot of really good sort of secular trends of, you know, just resilient to the food and beverage, and likewise with healthcare, with demographics, but also this clean energy. They've got this big sort of contract with Freya, who do EV batteries out in the States and in Norway. And if that goes well, you could see a real significant jump into the onto the top line. But even after the recent performance, I mean, I don't know how you'd view this as a trade, but certainly as an investment, I mean, it's still is only 11 times PE you know, on profitability that it doesn't reflect the 10 and 10 target. I don't know if you've ever had a look at this one, Michael.
I've traded it in the past.
Oh, have you? Okay. You've done well out of it, presumably.
Yeah, I've done all right on it. Yeah, I haven't looked at it recently. But if you look at that level, the 425 level,
yeah,
you know, it's broken out of a prior high, so I would consider that bullish. And then when you look at the volume, you've got bigger green candles, which signifies buying pressure. What I tend to look out for is when stocks are down on big volume days, because that means there's a lot of distribution, a lot of selling. Whereas in this case, it looks like you've got buyers pushing the price higher.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, also just on a sort of like on a fundamentals basis, I think I've got a price target of, I can't remember. Well, I think it's about £5 is my average blended sort of like, you know, range on a fair value. But I do think if you actually work out the 10 and 10 objective, the 10% organic growth long term on the top line and 10% EBIT margins, you can easily get north of £7.50. So it's not surprising it's getting some good volume there.
Yeah. And also with the pension. That's one thing that I should add for Reynolds does have quite a big pension deficit. To me, I don't think that's as risky as maybe some others feel like, because it is actually getting paid off and the company's quite resilient.
Yeah.
Obviously, if trading was to decline, then it could be a problem. But I should also disclose I hold Reynolds as well. So I'm certainly biased in talking my own book. But yeah, if I don't see that pension as being a problem to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking. You're right. I mean, it still trades. Yeah, it's only six times PE, isn't it? The
it's pretty low. Yeah,
it's pretty low even after that recent bounce. Okay, well, let's move to another one you quite like, which is Tortilla Mexican grill. And I think this is a bit like a smaller version of Chipotle out in the States. It does sort of like
it does
fresh burritos, doesn't it? Sort of like fresh ingredients, no artificial flavors or colorants and this sort of stuff. And I guess the beauty of this thing, you can go and try it out at the Coalface, a bit of mystery shopping.
You can, yeah. So I've had quite a few Deliveroo tortillas. Quite good. And yeah, this floated in 2021, didn't it? I think it was just horrifically overpriced. Yeah, the danger is you can't equate this to Chipotle because, you know, the UK isn't as familiar with Hispanic food, whereas unlike the US, literally borders it and you've got plenty more. This is like less well-known brand. And even Chipotle has struggled. I think there's one in Frankfurt and lived there. I think one's opened up in, I think there's a few in London, but you know, they don't have a presence at all in the UK. This is the biggest Mexican one that I know of.
Yeah. What's the product like?
The product is quite good. Yeah. I quite enjoy them. I mean, in London, there's such a range of places to eat. You know, I'm not a regular customer, but it's definitely good. In terms of the trade here, I don't own this, but it's growing, and you can sort of see how earnings will grow if they keep rolling out to new sites. But what is interesting recently is that Luke Johnson has taken a chunk and potentially removed the overhang.
Yeah.
So if you see that big volume spike at the start of the month, that's the overhang potentially clearing. So there's been a cleanup trade. Luke Johnson's got his hands on stock. I think there was someone else. I can't really remember now. But essentially what I'd be looking for is a tightening up of the stock and a breakout of that recent high, you know, a trend to potentially get on board. It's never going to be the world's most exciting stock, but potentially, you know, that there is a trade there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the fresh Mexican food sort of like phenomenon, certainly in the States, will eventually take off here in the UK because, you know, it's fresh food and it's tasty. And I think they've got, it all depends on whether they've got the right management team to be able to scale it quickly, I guess, because fast casual is pretty competitive, particularly with margins and stuff.
Yeah, I think they've chosen one delivery partner to enhance margins now. Yeah. So I think they've got rid of a few.
Yeah.
There's a guy from the restaurant group is on the management team. Whether that is a good thing, I'm not entirely sure, because restaurant group had a pretty dismal listed performance. Overpaid for Wagamama as well.
Yeah. But
yeah, in terms of a trade, this could be a potentially nice swing trade. They have spent quite a bit of money on rolling out units, which was what the IPO was for.
Yeah.
But if they can self-fund, you can see where the growth would come from.
Yeah.
And I think the market cap's like 18 million now. It doesn't really need to do a lot for investors to appreciate any growth.
Yeah.
And potentially get a nice move from that. It is a liquid, so not something you should pile into by all means, but potentially worth a look.
Yeah, if Luke Johnson thinks it's a good concept to roll out, then he's not an idiot, is he? He's the guy from Pizza Express, is he? Is he the
Pizza Express? He's had his highs and his lows. Yeah, he was also involved in Patisserie Valerie.
Oh yeah, okay,
Which obviously
went a bit south.
Yeah, it didn't end well. I think it's probably all we can say.
It got burrito, didn't it? Should we say Patisserie Valerie?
Yeah.
Okay, moving on the consumer the theme, we've got Supreme, which I know you've written about in, I think it was the Investors Chronicle just recently, and this one it's basically an FMCG branded and distribution business. It owns its own sort of vaping brands and also distributes vaping brands, but also has sports and nutrition, lighting, battery, And what I think, you know, investors are quite interested in is, you know, obviously your view of how you see it. But the government has basically put out all the legislation into the market in terms of trying to stop or stopping underage vaping. Also banning in about sort of 12 months time disposable vapes, and then recently in the budget put a tax on vaping, supposedly coming in I think in 2026. So what's sort of like particularly interesting is all the bad news now on a legislative front should be built into the stock price, and it trades at a crazily cheap valuation. I was just doing the numbers and it's less than 7x PE, and it's got a good strong balance sheet, and the growth and the upgraded has been exceptional. Like, what's your sort of like your view on Supreme?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. Everyone thinks it's a vaping company. It's got plenty more to it as well. But I mean, the growth here is quite impressive. The bad news is out. I can't really see, obviously the consultation was like a binary event. Yeah. So you got potentially bad news, but the way this company played it is quite impressive, because they released really good news on the day of the consultation, and the stock price actually closed above the previous close. So, you know, the shares on the day actually closed higher, even with the bad news into the market. I mean, that just says quite a lot about the business and how strong the performance is. Yeah, I think this could be a big winner. Could be wrong. Yeah. But if people do start to reprice that for growth and it keeps on beating expectations, got a strong balance sheet, I can't really see what the issue would be. I think the company's been very proactive in terms of this consultation, has even welcomed it. I mean, there was a case, was it in Bristol? Pretty much every corner shop was selling illegal vapes because nobody knew they were illegal. And, you know, these things are coming from China, stuffed with who knows what. Obviously not regulated. So, you know, the consultation is probably a good thing for the industry, because it's going to standardize things. It's going to take away a lot of unsafe things. And, you know, and there's some certainty on it as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, to me, this looks as though it's bottomed. We've had all the bad sort of government news and legislation, taxes, and all this sort of stuff. It's obviously depressed the valuation. But from now, that uncertainty is taken away. So it should, in theory, you know, given that the business is doing really well, it should, in theory, reprice. And let's be clear about it. I think tobacco stocks, which are terrible, you know, they're trading at a higher PE multiple than Supreme, which is on vaping. Yeah. So it just needs to be repriced.
Yeah, I mean, those businesses are also more established, so you could say they're somewhat less risk. Yeah. But then, are you getting the same upside from those companies? I personally would say no. Yeah. You know, for British American Tobacco and Imperial Tobacco to double, they've got to add billions in market cap, whereas Supreme to double, it's not, you know, I mean, who knows? Personally, I think it's a lot more achievable in terms of the risk to reward. I guess everyone's got to make their own decision.
Yeah, I actually think this will be bought out as well eventually, because you've got the likes of Philip Morris, which are splitting or has split its tobacco with its sort of like new, what they call it, you know, I think new vaping sort of like business, or, you know, sort of like non-carcinogen business. And I think it's that second part of the operation which will be beefing up. And I think BAT and Imperial Tobacco are going to do exactly the same. They're going to grow into sort of vaping businesses, and it just looks like a bit of a trophy asset trading at a ridiculously low valuation to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't be averse to someone taking it over. So as long as it's at a good price and not like 10% higher like Acrol's this morning.
Acrol was another bid, was it today or something?
Management have recommended it. I think it was 38 pence. Let's quickly check.
This is the toilet paper, price. Tissue toilet paper manufacturer.
This is the tissue toilet paper. Yeah, let me.
I'll just put it on the screen. Yeah, I see what you mean. It just shot up again. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it, how we've had sort of so many takeovers recently.
Yeah, I mean, the price was trading that in January, so it disappointing, really. But they've actually blamed the market.
Yeah.
Acral's management have blamed the market. They said they've had upgrades, they've restored the business because, you know, several years ago it was doing terrible, needed refinancing. And since then the business has performed pretty well. But according to management, the market undervalues it. And if they want to expand, they're going to have to raise equity or debt. And they just don't think the market will be that supportive. So for that reason, they've decided to recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. Another one, which actually is just a bit of M&A interest we've had in this week as well, and I know investors have asked about, is Equals, which is a stock that I own. It's actually my largest position. And I don't know if you've been following this one, but it's basically a Forex international payments platform that has got, you know, been growing. It's in the B2B sector, so it doesn't do sort of very little amount of consumer sort of stuff. And it provides a sort of platform to allow corporates to be able to transact abroad in terms of different, different currencies, and puts a sort of like a consultancy advisory layer on it. Anyway, 6 months ago, it got interest from two parties, Fleet Corps and Madison Dearborn. Fleet Corps are a trade buyer. They've got a similar sort of like international payments business out in the States, wanting to expand abroad, huge business. And Madison Dearborn are a private equity guys. And that's been going on for some time. Fleet Corps dropped out immediately in the actual bid. So they excluded themselves. And then this week, what happened was that the put up or shut up extension was further pushed forward by another 4 weeks until the day after their final results are being released. I think so. It goes to the 17th is the put up or shut up, and the results are coming out on the 16th. But then there came news from Sky, who seem to always get this breaking news on sort of like, you know, bids, that Lord Hammonds, who's the ex-chancellor of the UK, his business he chairs, Rails is put a proposal, non-binding, to the board to get together, and they're a sort of like another B2B trade company in sort of payments, but not in the Forex side, and obviously that sort of ticked up. And I think for investors, if you're in here like I am, it's sort of like I'm personally going to sort of like just hold and just wait and see. I think with more than one party, two people interested, the chances of actually having a agreed bid are much higher now. And I would not, you know, sort of exclude totally Fleet Corps coming back in, because they, as soon as a bid's put in, they can come back, and I know it would be a perfect acquisition target for those guys, and they may be interested thereafter if the price isn't particularly high. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this one, but it seems to be a pretty interesting takeover scenario.
Yeah, I've not looked at it for a while. I remember, I think it was a few months ago, the company announced it was putting itself up for sale, and the price shot up.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I'm not sure I'll be long here, because if nobody offers to bid it for it straight away, the price is going to come right back down. And that's exactly what happened. But since then, I've not really looked at it. But if you've got a couple of interested parties, that definitely bodes well for the price, right?
Yeah. I suppose when it comes to sort of trading, et cetera, given we've had so much M&A, you haven't been going short too much, I guess. It's all been long positions, I imagine, because if you're short and there's somebody comes out with a big bid on the day, then you're going to be absolutely stuffed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the time for shorting was sort of 2022 and early last year. Now, I think it's just, you know, unless you've got a special situation where the company is running out of cash or something like that, you've got to be very careful what you short. I don't have any shorts at the moment, pretty much all, you know, unless it's like an intraday short. But all my swing positions are long, and probably will be for the foreseeable future. I can't see me being net short at all anytime soon.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to another one in this sort of consumer area. Let's go to Reach, which is the... effectively, I think they own the Mirror, the newspaper publisher, but moving increasingly into the sort of the digital environment. I think they've got a bit of a pension, another one, a bit of a pension deficit, which has been sorted out. But they seem to be reasonably resilient, albeit it's obviously it looks like a bit of a melting ice cube, this one, a value play that is going to degrade. Because, I mean, essentially, print advertising is struggling a bit and actually trying to win in a digital environment against the likes of Google, Facebook, and increasingly Amazon is quite tough.
Yeah. I mean, this if you go on any of their sites, they're just awful. So I don't really know why anyone would advertise or even read it. But if you look at the cash flows, it's been, as you said, pretty resilient. There's going to be the conclusion to this, I think, in 2029, which is quite far away, but there is some certainty on it now.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought this was potentially interesting because it rallied quite a lot. And then I wanted to see if there would be any consolidation. But so far, it's carried on going higher. So for me, I'm probably not going to trade this anymore. But I thought it was worth flagging.
I mean, it isn't the kind of thing I would particularly go sort of like full bore into, because I don't really...
Understand. This is quite a horrible business.
Another one, just finishing on the consumer side that I'd highlight to investor is the Rank group. And the reason why I mention this, because let me just put the chart up. It basically is a casino and bingo operator in the UK. It owns Mecca Bingo and the Grosvenor casino estate. I don't actually own the shares, but what's really sort of quite interesting is that when you read the management presentation and you look at sort of the government legislation, they're allowing land-based casinos to materially increase the number of slot machines in their sites, doubling, in fact, once the legislation goes through in the summer. And this is, if everybody knows, you know, casinos, if they ever go to Vegas, they're just stuffed full of slot machines because they're just so, so popular rather than the actual tables. And this could make a massive difference to their profitability for largely a fixed cost base, you know, a casino. They don't need that many people. And most of it is just rent, et cetera, and paying gambling taxes. So it's the shares have been absolutely, you know, knocked in terms of just sentiment in the small cap sector, down to 66p. But I think this could really turn, particularly if the UK economy doesn't go into recession and you start seeing more and more people returning to sort of like, you know, to casinos, and also international tourists deciding to go along with it, because, you know, the popularity of slot machines is well trodden trade. So it's an interesting one to me. I think the shares are very reasonably valued, even on low expectations. They currently trade on roughly around about 13 times PE. I don't know if you've ever had a look at these.
Not for a while, no, because that to me looks like a stage four downtrend. But it wasn't that long ago that these fixed odds betting terminals had some regulation, right? Because I remember basically booking companies were just opening units everywhere, and just stuffing the fob tees in them. And I think, what was it? Was there a restriction on how many they could have or something, which significantly damaged the profitability? So is that now being reversed, or
no? What you're mentioning is the actual betting shops. So the likes of Ladbrokes, William Hill, you know, Betfred, and these kind of guys, then they had a limit number on the amount of fixed odds betting. These are slot machines, which are not fixed. They're similar, but they're not the same as fixed odds betting shops. Right. And what they did was that they basically stopped. Their previous legislation had a ratio of tables to slot machines that put a ceiling on the number of slot machines. But what it meant was that there was lack of investment going into casinos, which was not exactly what the government wanted. Hence, they've put this new legislation together to be able to change it after a consultation, increasing the number of slot machines. So what you're going to see, but you raise a really good point, what you're going to see is the Grosvenor estate and probably the Mecca estate significantly improve profits going forward.
Yeah.
But their digital side, because they've got this new legislation reducing the bet size for online gambling from down to £5 per spin, I think, for anybody over 25, and £2 per spin for anybody between 18 and 25. Because of that, that will hit their digital side. but because they're land-based, they're going to make the net is much higher for them. So obviously it's something that you have to basically, you know, have faith with, that people still want to use, you know, slot machines and, you know, enjoy it. But if that's the case, which is what's happened always in history and everywhere else in the world, then there'll be a material increase in the profitability of these businesses on a largely fixed cost base.
That's quite interesting, because that, you know, when things significantly change in a business is quite interesting to me, because it typically takes some time for it to be fully priced.
Yeah.
So knowing that, I'm actually going to go research that and look for a technical entry that could get me long to take advantage of that, preferably in an uptrend. But if you can see that 100 line there
The
chart.
Yeah, let me put that back up.
Yeah, there's been some support there in the past.
Yeah.
Is that October 2020? Then you got some price action there in April 2022, July 2023. So I would class that 100 as a big round number that is support and resistance. And then at least if the price is at 100, you know, it's sort of had a decent move from 66. So potentially uptrending again. That's quite an interesting pick. Yeah, thank you for flagging that up.
Yeah, well, let me know what you think when we chat next time. Okay, well, let's move to another sector. We've got payments again. Actually, it's one you quite like, which is PCI Pal, which is a small business in the UK, and I think it does secure payments to for sort of communication call centers, etc., in the UK and in the US. Can you take us through just quickly what it does and exactly and why you like it? Let me put the chart up.
Yeah. So I hold the position here.
Yeah.
And what it does is cloud-based payments. It's growing very... So there's new legislation, PCI ESS, I think it is, similar to GDPR, whereas if you have a breach, you've got to pay quite a material... I think, is it like 4% of revenue is the max potential fine?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what this company does is take that risk off a company and outsource it and manage it for them. You know, so if you let's say you're a big insurance company, your core business is insurance, you want to spend your time and money doing the high margin insurance stuff, not necessarily building out teams and things which are taking your attention away from that onto managing risk of payments. Better if you can just outsource it to a specialist, pay them money, and you can focus on your core competency. So that's really the offer.
Are they a bit like Echo, where they do basically, they mask the credit card data? So effectively, somebody calls into into a call center, it means that they don't have to take that 3-digit security ID. They just tap it into their mobile or the telephone, and therefore you don't get that potential fraud.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't have to give... You're not giving... Yeah, so if you call up and pay for something, they will switch the software on, whether it's Echoes or PCI Pals or another competitors. You tap in your details. That agent never gets to see your details.
Yeah.
So there's no risk of a breach, because they're not even getting access to it. So the payment is taking place. But, you know, sometimes you have to read out a card detail to someone on the phone, which I personally don't feel comfortable doing. And if you use Revolut, you can get a virtual one-use card. So you can pay once and you know, then it expires after that. But a lot of businesses are using this because of the risks, and it's easier, it's automated, and you're getting rid of the risk. Customs are sticky. I think they lost one, the NHS test and trace thing. From memory, there has been a few others, but generally the net retention rate is over 100. So not only are they winning business, they're expanding. So it's like a land and expand strategy. There is one big potential downside with this US case.
It's a litigation, is it?
It is, yeah. So private equity backed Securio launched a suit against PCI Pal in, was it September 2021? When the price was 89 pence.
Mm.
So the price has, you know, fallen considerably. In that time, they've actually offered to buy PCI Pal for 90 pence, which understandably the board rejected. I also wouldn't have been pleased with that. I mean, it's a quick win, but personally, I think the value is much higher. But the way that the court case works is they're being sued in the US and the UK. They've won a comprehensive victory in the UK and also invalidated Securio's patent, so left Securio in a weaker position. The appeal is next month. If they win that, they will be entitled some money, and that'll be the UK case done with. The company has already got a solution, even though the UK case said that it didn't infringe on Securio's. So in my view, the company is over, sorry, the market is over attributing risk to this business, where in fact the risk is not entirely as bad as everyone thinks. That's just my view.
Yeah,
could always be wrong. And with lawsuits, you never know how they are going to go. So, you know, it's in probably everyone's interest to get this resolved. Because Securio is spending money and they are losing. They're going to spend more money and potentially even lose more. But the business has just raised at zero discount. I think it was over 3 million. They did get offered more. I was supportive of this raise because I think, you know, if you can raise that money, then you remove the cash balance concern. And they're in a strong position already with the UK case potentially done in a month's time, assuming it all goes well from the appeal. But yeah, certainly a lot of risk, but this is growing very quickly in a huge, huge market.
How competitive is the market?
It's quite competitive. There's a couple of providers, but it's big enough for everyone. It's not. You know, there's a lot of runway to go in this market.
And how long have you held this position? I guess it's not a trade. This one's investment, isn't it?
Yeah, so I've had a position in family accounts since 2021. So this is probably a longer one. And I've taken a position this year in my own personal accounts as well.
Okay.
But in my view, this isn't a technical trade because obviously the chart looks terrible. But it's an asymmetric risk to reward trade in my view.
Yeah.
So the upside potentially outweighs the downside. But obviously the downside, if the case goes wrong, is huge. So this is certainly a risky trade. And even though it's cash generative and this year it's going to be profitable because of that lawsuit, I think if you remove the lawsuit, the price doubles at least, because it was 89 pence before the lawsuit. The company's in a much better position. But yeah, it's definitely not for those who are risk averse.
Yeah, well, I guess the guys who there's Securio, whatever it was, they could Securio, they could put another bid on the company, couldn't they? That would take away the litigation.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is that the price has been softened up by them, so yeah, it's pretty cheeky to put in a 1p premium.
Yeah, well, we'll wait and see. Okay, good. That's a nice one. I like that. Another one which I had a question from an investor before here was basically just what my thoughts on an update on it. It's a very popular retail share. It's Avacta. And it came out with news this week that it just started its second regime dosing, its fortnightly dosing of its lead drug AVA 6000. It'd previously gone through 18 months of phase 1A trialing for 3 week dosing regime, and it came out with excellent safety, patient tolerability data, and also early efficacy data showing that the actual chemotherapy in terms of the AVA 6000 was being deposited on the tumor, and and having some effect, or it's early stages of some effect without being deposited elsewhere. And now they're putting it into patients out in the States with a 2-weekly dosing regime. And the idea of that is to sort of see whether it improves the efficacy of that. And the idea then is to go in, once you've collected that data, to then go into phase 2 trials, which will be pivotal by the end of 2024, mm-hmm. which then should rubber stamp the precision platform for it. What's also quite interesting, and I think, just for investors, is that I was actually at a medical science day that the company hosted about 18 months ago, and they had an industry expert in all things chemotherapy. And what he was saying, which was really interesting, was that if you can ever get a prodrug, which is this is effectively what it is, to allow more cycles of dosing for patients, then that would be an absolute game changer for the chemotherapy industry, because the biggest Achilles heel for chemotherapy is that it is so toxic, particularly around the heart, without any protection of like the AVA6000, that you have to limit it. And so what that means is that if the safety data for the prodrug for AVA6000 stays the same with the sort of 2-weekly format, and it allows more cycles to go through, you could really see a huge extension of that sort of chemotherapy. And what that also means is, which again, and it's this is my understanding, so I haven't spoken to the company of it, is that because it's activated by FAP enzymes on the tubula, which don't exist or hardly exist anywhere else in the body, because it's FAP enzymes, then what that means is that cancers can't hide from the actual treatment, because one of the biggest problems with immunotherapies, which is the next generation of cancer treatments, is that the cancer vaccines is that they are effectively triggered by like spike proteins, as you saw during the pandemic. And what cancers are very good at is mutating to hide themselves from immunotherapies, and they only last for certain 18 months, 2 years. But because it's FAP activated, the AVA6000, then in my view, I don't think they're going to have any chance of hiding from it, because that's basically that's what they're made of. They've got that surround. It isn't a biomarker. It's basically what they are. So if they don't have FAP, then they won't be carcinogenic. So you've won either way. So I thought that was quite interesting. I don't know if you've ever had a look at a Avacta. Obviously, it's just gone through a big placing at 30p. And that shows you just how painful it is.
It's
30 million at 50p, sorry. And it just shows you how painful it is to raise money if you can in the small cap sector. But they've got that, and they should have their cash runway should be extended into 2026. But this is a trader's sort of joy stock, I guess. But it gets a lot of sort of a lot of people putting their opinion out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, Paul, I don't really understand anything that you just explained there.
Oh, I see,
it's above
okay.
My pay grade. I'm not a medical, technical guy. Yeah. I'd have to sort of go away and do my research on that. But, as a trader's stock, I guess it's quite interesting, although not one I have actively traded myself. Mm. But what you just said about raising money there is spot on. If a company needs money in this market, it's going to get punished. And I have no idea why businesses just don't raise more and raise money when they don't need it, rather than when they've got like 6 months left, because not only does the market knows you need it, so they can afford to, you've got investors coming in and say, well, actually, I'm going to offer you at this price, and because you need it, you're going to take it.
Yeah.
And then you've also got shorters, some people like me coming in shorting the stock, looking to either cover in the placing or cover when the funding uncertainty has been removed. Management teams should be aware of this. They're professionals. They've got brokers. They've got PR companies advising them. I don't really think there's sort of any excuse for leaving it so late to raise money. Mm. Now it could be a brilliant entry for new investors at 50 pence with all of this technology they've got. They've got a long cash runway, so there's no uncertainty on cash. They can sort of use that runway to build value. But I think it's been sort of well aware that the company has needed money. I mean, it's, as I say, it's not one I've followed, but really, you shouldn't be leaving it so late.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. Well, hopefully later on in the year, we'll see interest rates come down and it'll make it a bit easier for businesses to raise money.
Yeah.
Okay, we come down to one of the, it's a Argo blockchain that I know, I think you're thinking about going short, or you may be short. And this is a Bitcoin miner based largely, I think, in North America, in the US and Canada. It's been through the mill a bit. I mean, if you just look at the actual chart, it was a, it, before the pandemic,
yeah.
it was sort of one, or it was about 3 or 4p, and then it absolutely shot up and topped out at round about £3, and has come down to 13.
Yeah, this is a crazy stock. but you know, this one, it was clear they needed to raise money. They still need to raise money, because they've sold all of their Bitcoin reserves, you know, to stay afloat and pay the bills. So they have very little left. Anything that they're mining, they're selling. And next month, we've got the halving of Bitcoin, which means, you know, the Bitcoin price needs to at least double from this level just to get back to where it was.
So what's the halving? Sorry, what's the halving of the Bitcoin price?
So I'm no expert on Bitcoin or cryptos, but from my understanding is it becomes doubly as difficult to mine because it like halves. So I could be wrong on that.
Right, okay. It becomes twice as expensive to mine, you're saying?
Yeah, so in effect, the value of it increases. You know, if it's like doubly as expensive to mine in real terms, the price would have to double.
Yes.
But that's the problem. The price would double and it would still be, you know, achieving the same rate because, you know, therefore it needs to at least more than double because the company's just not doing enough to stay afloat. It did raise money in January, but it's just not enough. It needs to raise more. Something needs to happen because, you know, you can see the Bitcoin price has been rallying and yet Argo blockchain hasn't been going anywhere. And the reason for that is because it needs more money. So I'm not short of it. I have thought about going short it, but it's pretty risky because this is just a crazy volatile stock. You know, when it broke out of that sort of 15p level, I was very aware it needed money, but then it rallied all the way to 30. So if you're short, you could potentially be 100%+ in the hole before you were even right. So yeah, it's very high risk, long or short. But yeah, I think this is just a complete avoid and leave it to someone else for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's got $55 million of net debt even after the fundraise. So you're right, it needs to raise money. And if the business model is just about to fall, i.e. because the price of, you know, of mining goes up significantly and the price of selling Bitcoin doesn't, then, you've got a real issue there. Plus, I guess longer term, once the industry's mined all its Bitcoin, then it's got nothing else to mine anyway, has it?
I think that's quite far away.
Okay.
But yeah, you're right. Eventually, yeah, it would need to sort of diversify. But certainly the pressing issue is sorting out that balance sheet and staying alive because it's just not getting its hash rate up, which is the mining rate of Bitcoins. So, you know, anyone can do this. You know, you look at the numbers and it's a complete void. Yeah. Doesn't mean it can't go up, of course. You know, it could go up 100% tomorrow.
Yeah,
crazier things have happened, but I'll be avoiding it.
Yeah, okay. Oh, one miner that people might want to look at, which I haven't, I don't own, but I do like and have been monitoring, is Fresnillo, which is the gold and silver miner out in Mexico, and it's actually got some really good long life assets out there. I think the life of the assets are well over 30 years if you look at their sort of resources in both gold and silver. It's the world's biggest silver producer, but it also does gold as well. And as you see, the shares have been really badly hit of late, and that's largely because of US interest rates going up. It's obviously gold and silver's priced in dollars, and if interest rates go up in the US, then the differential and the yield, because you don't get paid a yield holding gold or silver, you get paid a yield in US dollars from the Federal Reserve, and therefore it's hit the share price. Plus, what's also happened is that because you've had China, you've had a lot of reshoring away from China into places, nearshoring into places like Mexico. It's meant the local currency and the peso is actually appreciated against the dollar. So it's meant their local mining costs have gone up. Basically that squeezed margins. But to me, that's all, you know, transitory. If we do see a reduction in interest rates in the States, which is what everybody expected, and that's what the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, was saying this week, plus you start then, you know, seeing a weakening of the Mexican peso, this one could change very, very rapidly. And as I say, it's got very big long life assets. The thing is, for the next 2 years, they do actually have to put quite a bit of capex in to access those. So there's quite a lot of investment they need to make to just for the first next 2 years, just to keep production stable, and then it'll expand elsewhere. But assuming that they manage to do that, this could re-rate significantly if you believe that interest rates are obviously, you know, coming down, and it gives you a geopolitical hedge against sort of like, you know, as gold as a store of value would, and silver does as a store of value. Plus, if the, you know, industry, the global GDP starts to accelerate, silver's used a lot for industrial applications as well. They should do well. And the gold and the silver price, as you probably know, is they've got the gold currently prices at a record $2,200 per ounce, and silver's at about 25 per pound as well, ounce. So it's, you know, it's pretty cheap, actually. I don't know if you've ever had a think about Priscilla at all.
Now, looking at that chart, it's not something I would ever look too much in
it
detail.
It looks terrible,
at.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, but if I eyeball that chart, that 600 level looks to have been support and resistance. It seems, you know, it's funny with the efficient market, how prices always tend to gravitate around these big, big round numbers. But yeah, 600 would look to be a potential level, assuming there would be, you know, sideways consolidation. Because the problem is, if that would run back up to 600 now, you know, within the next 2 weeks, you've got a lot of people sitting on paper profit quite quickly. But you don't have to go too far back to find people who were in at a loss and are now getting back to break even, and then, you know, provide supply to the share price because they just want out the break even trade. Hence why, if you get that consolidation, you can sort of wring those investors out, and give the shares a new base to trade from. That's what I would look for first, and then I would look at the fundamentals, as you said.
I mean, and the other thing for investors is to bear in mind, there's a lot of consolidation in the mining sector, particularly in precious metals. You've had some gold miners buying each other, so it would not be a big surprise if one of the US guys, you actually put a number on these ones, because it's a no-brainer. You know, you get consolidation. It's just near shore. It's in Mexico. It's in that NAFTA agreement. So it looks perfect to a certain extent. But hey, I'm just an idiot sort of stock picker.
Well, aren't we all? Yeah. So
I know. Okay, let me just see whether there's any more questions. No, we're okay on all the questions. So thanks very much, Michael, for your excellent.
Thanks
comment.
For having me on, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, we'll do it again in the next couple of months, and we'll have some more sort of like, you know, some trades. So thanks again, and look forward in chatting in due course.
Yeah, likewise. Take care. Have a good weekend.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.